Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Our extraordinary producers, I wanted to give them a shout out to Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and our technical director today, Henry Frain. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll do something we do every month on the show on the third Friday. We'll talk about personal finance. David Sino is our guest. He is a professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. He is also an extraordinary guest when it comes to personal finance matters. He has a wide range of education and background and experience, and we'll talk with him about some of the trends going on in the economy and what it means to individuals and families trying to save, invest, and look to the future. Your questions are welcome during this hour. If you would like to join us, the number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the state. Actually, anywhere in the U.S., if you're listening online, you can use our toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. And David Sino, good morning.
Well, good morning, Jack. And as always, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. This morning, I'd like to take just a few minutes and discuss a particular asset class that we sometimes don't spend enough time talking about, yet it's extremely important, and that asset class being real estate. Now, I must tell you that some of these introductory remarks are based upon a recent lecture actually given in my class by Professor John Masetich, who is a professor of finance at UC San Diego and also an adjunct professor at the University of Illinois. Professor Masetich referred to a recent Wall Street Journal article entitled, "Is Your Home in a Bubble?" Now, I think most of us are familiar with the concept of market bubbles. In fact, for many of us, it is painful to recall the high-tech and dot-com stock market bubble, back in 2000 and 2001 and 2002, where many investors watched enormous paper gains in the stock market disappear. They sort of evaporated, and even their initial capital hemorrhaged, leaving stock market investors with losses of some 60, 70, 80% or even more. Those were pretty tough times. It truly was a period of, shall we call it, irrational exuberance? I think we remember that term from Alan Greenspan. And you may recall that short-lived concept of, that was a new economy, or the old rules don't just apply any longer. Well, once again, Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan sounded the alarm just a few months ago when he said that while a severe drop in U.S. home prices is unlikely, quote, local economies may experience speculative imbalances. Now, I think that's doublespeak for watch out. If you're in a home market where prices have rapidly escalated far beyond the average of most markets, you may be in for a nasty correction. At least that's my interpretation of what he was saying. Now, with that in mind, here's the good news. During the past 40 years, single-family homes on average have appreciated at an annual rate of somewhere between 7 and 8% annually. That's a phenomenal record of success. We haven't had 40 consecutive years in the stock market without losses. We certainly haven't had 40 consecutive years without losses in the bond markets. So this is really phenomenal. And interestingly enough, here's some other good news. In spite of tremendous housing appreciation in many markets all throughout the United States over the past 3 years, the average household is still spending just about the same percentage of their household income for home ownership that they were spending some 3 years ago. And that approximates about 22 cents of every household dollar is being spent on home ownership today. And that's about the same percentage that was being spent some 3 years ago. Now, there's a lot of reasons for that. Interest rates have trended down until very recently. So people have been able to get mortgages at lower interest rates, many of them refinancing these mortgages. So that is a major element of keeping that 22% number in line. Now, some bad news. Several major studies have concluded that if you buy a single-family home and you live in the home for only 3 to 4 years, and then you go ahead and sell it, you may actually lose money. This was based upon a massive Harvard study looking at tens of thousands of real estate transactions throughout the country. And it's due to the fact that there is a very high entry and high exit costs when it comes to a purchase and a sale of a personal residence. These costs may include commissions, for example, generally in the 6% range in central Illinois, but higher indeed elsewhere. Financing costs in the 1% to 2% range when you procure that mortgage. Annual maintenance costs, annual real estate taxes, fix-up costs when you go to sell that home, etc. And the break-even on home ownership seems to be in that 4 to 5 year range because it's very, very difficult to amortize all of these costs over a very short period of time and come out at least delta neutral. Now, what factors really drive housing prices? Certainly low interest rates, which makes housing more affordable for many of us. And of course, we have enjoyed a low interest rate environment for a number of years. One can still go out and procure a 30-year conventional mortgage in that 6% or perhaps just a little bit less than a 6% range. Truly still a wonderful rate. Factors such as increasing population certainly drive housing demand. In fact, the U.S. population is rapidly approaching 300 million of us. I wonder where we're going to put all of these folks. However, you may be surprised to learn that the major factor influencing housing prices in a given market over a long period of time is not interest rates, it's not population, it's net job creation. Net job creation. That is the number of jobs created versus the number of jobs lost in a given area. Invariably, housing prices are most sustainable and are increasing beyond national averages in those markets where net jobs are being created. And really, when I think about net jobs, I'm thinking about decent net jobs, good net jobs are being created. So if I was moving to an unfamiliar area of the country and I was contemplating a home purchase, I want hard data on job creation and really more likely net job creation. Where am I going to get this data? Well, some of that data might be available through the internet, simply going to U.S. Census information, which is updated periodically, or perhaps the local chamber of commerce in your area might be one of the best because they probably have the most information on job creation. Another way of looking at housing prices is to compare the increase in housing prices with increases in the personal income of an individual. Now, Smart Money Magazine created a housing index which basically compares local incomes in an area with local housing prices. And when salaries and home prices increase at a similar percentage rate, Smart Money concludes, well, that market is fairly valued. However, if housing prices surge way ahead of local incomes, that market is overvalued. And of course, where you have price increases really falling behind the income of an area, that would be an undervalued area. While this is just one measure of comparing market prices, nevertheless, the results are quite interesting. Based upon that index, the most overvalued housing markets are, surprise, surprise, Orange County, California, Ventura, California, San Diego, California. In fact, 10 of the 15 most overvalued markets are indeed in California, where average home prices are well beyond the $400,000 plus range. Now, let's take a look at that index for some of what we would refer to as fairly valued. That is where prices are moving up, but so are incomes. They're sort of in lockstep, sort of in tandem. And these are areas where we have had solid appreciation. Let's give you some examples. Nashville, Tennessee. And over the last 5 years, houses have appreciated at approximately 20%. Hartford, Connecticut. Boise City, Idaho. Toledo, Ohio. Fort Collins, Colorado. They've had appreciation of 35 to 40%, yet salaries have dramatically increased in that particular area, so we call that a fairly valued area. And interestingly enough, one of the other fairly valued areas in the Midwest is St. Louis. We've had good job growth, we've had good increases in homes, but again, based upon this index, fairly valued. Well, where is it undervalued? Where have incomes actually moved up faster than the price of homes? Fargo, Moorhead, North Dakota. Now, I don't know how cold it is up there today. Maybe Mike or Ed could tell us how cold it is up there today, but I probably don't want to be there today. Dayton, Ohio. Houston, Texas. How about Memphis, Tennessee? A pretty dynamic area. Syracuse, New York. Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Fort Worth, Arlington, Texas. Montgomery, Alabama. So there you have it. You have sort of a menu of areas all across the country where you have decently priced housing based upon net job creation as well as the incomes of individuals. Now, unquestionably for most of us, the equity in our homes is an important aspect of our overall financial net worth. Therefore, it's especially important that we carefully do our homework before we purchase or overextend ourselves on a large mortgage. And as I have counseled in the past, you don't want to be facing a burdensome mortgage payment when you retire. In fact, many retirees actually size down, take their profits, just to avoid a potential mortgage payment and negative cash flow situation at retirement. Also, remember, if your home is rapidly appreciating and you sell it and you have lived in it for the past 2 years as your personal residence, IRS gives us a break. IRS says you don't have to pay the tax on the gain or the profit on the first $500,000 of gain or profit from the sale if you are married. And if you are a single individual, the number is $250,000. Now, that doesn't happen too often in central Illinois, Jack. I don't think it's happened to me. I don't know if it's happened to you. But, hey, maybe that's something we have to look forward to. So that's certainly positive news for people who have the good fortune of owning a rapidly appreciating home. So again, some caution. Is residential real estate overpriced? Probably in some areas. It's probably fairly priced in others. And maybe there are some of these areas where it's actually underpriced. Bottom line, do your homework. Bottom line, if you're only going to live in that property for a year, 2 years, maybe three, pretty tough to even break even unless you are very lucky, very fortunate to be in a very hot and appreciating area. And if you believe interest rates are moving up, well, that probably is going to have some dampening impact on this rapid escalation, this rapid appreciation of residential homes. So there you have it, a brief idea of are we in a bubble, a potential bubble, etc. And I'd be delighted to try to answer further questions on this topic or, of course, tackle other financial planning questions from our listening audience.
Well, very good. We have a caller waiting. We'll get to in a moment. Let me just mention the phone numbers again and that we are talking about personal finance with David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Your questions are welcome on either the real estate issue that we began with or any other personal finance topics. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. We have an Indiana listener on line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. Two questions. The first one is you're talking about some graphs, and I was wondering if I'm sure they do, but keep track of the number of mortgages where the bank has to evict somebody and close it down and offer it for sale again. I wonder if you have any percentages on that. You know, is that a sort of thing that correlates well with anything, overabundance or underabundance or whatever?
That's a great question. Actually, it's been a pretty stable number. It's been a pretty stable number in the 1% to 2% range, as I recall, and it hasn't moved very much. I think a lot of that is a factor of interest rates have stayed pretty stable. In fact, a lot of people have actually been able to refinance at lower rates. What I really caution about, and if you really look at those numbers and you look where those foreclosures are coming from, they're typically coming from mortgages where people have sort of been drawn in with no money down or no requirements to qualify other than equity in your home, for example. That's where those foreclosures are taking place. But in the long-term conventional mortgage market, we really haven't seen a lot of that foreclosure. Now, I haven't really looked at statistics because you've asked a really good question. The relationship of foreclosures in a particular area of the country and what impact that's had on housing prices. I really don't have that information at my fingertips, but it's a great thing to look into, and I'll try to look into that for the next program.
Okay, now the next thing I was wondering if there's a general, I guess I'll call it an algorithm. You mentioned in California, San Diego, Ventura, and Orange, and all that, that the price of a home is like $400,000. Now, under regular scrutiny by the bank, what would one have to earn per year if it's looked at that way, or whether it's looked at in terms of expendable income you can use later on? How much money you need to be making per year to get into that kind of market?
Well, you got to be making well in excess of $100,000, it seems to me. I mean, remember that there is a rule of thumb that you take your gross income, and basically that gross income is in the area of 28%. And that 28% needs to cover your real estate taxes, your insurance, and your monthly mortgage payment. And on those $400,000 properties with conventional financing, you're going to see people that are in the low six figures that are handling that. But in California, just to survive, a couple of people working, they better be in the low six figures with their incomes as well. But now, just for example, over the last 5 years in San Diego alone, appreciation has been over 100%. That's a 20% compounding per year.
Yeah.
Pretty darn tough. You know, things eventually regress to the mean. Not saying that San Diego is going to have a huge negative impact and housing prices are going down, although Professor Macedich, who I was talking to just yesterday, said, you know, for the first time in San Diego, California, housing prices have finally leveled off. And now the questions at the cocktail party are not whether the prices are going up, but are they going to not only level off but go down? So where you've seen these rapid appreciations in just some of these California communities where you see 100% increases, you know, it just can't continue forever. So things eventually regress to the mean. It reminds me a little bit of the high-tech bubble where you just can't go up 20, 40, 60, 80% a year and expect that to continue.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. A couple callers waiting. We'll get next to a listener in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, you mentioned the 2 years. What's the requirement, something about 5 years? Is that after you sold the house previously? Is that the way that works, or what's that?
Well, there are a couple of other rules. The first rule, the best rule, is that if you live in a house consecutively for 2 years, you call it your own personal residence, and then you sell it. If you're a single person and you have a gain, you don't pay tax on the first $250,000 of gain. If you are married, it's $500,000. There's another rule that is a five-year rule that isn't used nearly as often anymore, and that is has to do with if you've lived in the house two of the previous 5 years and you've called it your personal residence, then you roll into another house and you can defer the gain so long as you purchase a more expensive house.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different rule. Most people now are using the two-year rule, but some people, you know, and that's a tricky rule. You've got to prove that you were in that house for two consecutive years. Now, interestingly enough, what if you sell the house after two consecutive years and you take your gain and you move somewhere else into another house and you're lucky again, you just have the golden gift or something, and you're going to sell the next house and you're going to make more money. Can you do this all over again? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes. This is not a one-time deal. This continues.
And that's no matter. It used to be based on your age, too. You had to be over 55.
Yeah. No, that day is over. Mm-hmm. That day is over.
So it shows that if you use smart money, right, in terms of tracking your every 2 years, is that right?
Yeah, it's, and that's a pretty good trick. If you can pull that off, that's very impressive. But that is the rule.
Is that in a recent issue of Smart Money, the information that you cited?
I'm trying to think of where that article took place, but I believe it was in the October 2004 issue of Smart Money.
The other question is that what about this market here? How does this have you applied these statistics to the Champaign area?
Well, I think the Champaign area has had inflation, but it doesn't have the kinds of inflation that you see in these other areas, and part of that is because of developable land. For better or for worse, we have substantial amounts of farmland that can be turned into subdivisions and development. And remember that when we're talking about residential real estate, in most areas, land appreciates faster than bricks and sticks, or land appreciates faster than the construction project on it. So where you have limited amounts of buildable land, that also is going to put upward pressure on home ownership prices. Where here, still in central Illinois, we have this magnificent, bountiful farmland, which in many cases is turning into bricks and sticks. I'm not making a value judgment on that. I'm simply saying that we have substantial amounts of land, and that, in the long run, keeps prices reasonable. So we really have very reasonable prices in Champaign-Urbana. And I think when you look at national reports on livability of areas, the Champaign always ranks very well because we have the University of Illinois, we have outstanding health care facilities, and we have decent homeowners' prices.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. We're almost at our midpoint here with David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, talking about personal finance and taking your questions. We have a couple callers waiting and room for others if you'd like to join us. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. 800-222-9455 anywhere else. We'll go next to a listener in Aurora on line number two. Good morning.
Yes. Hi. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Nice to hear from you.
It's nice to speak with you also. I recently was able to get the opportunity to make an investment and then get as a reward, I don't know what you call that. You can give me the correct terminology. They give you 15 or 20 places that you can visit or go on vacation as far as, and the cost is free for the trip there.
But in other words, to look at a timeshare, for example?
No, they don't call it timeshare.
Mm-hmm.
It's just if you have so much money in the bank, you go to the dinner once a year.
Okay, okay.
And they give you these benefits.
Okay.
And they did have an option. What you had to do, though, was to put more new money into a
CD?
They didn't call it a CD. They just, you put 2 point something money in, and then you can get the advantages of these places to visit, these resorts.
So in other words, by adding more money at your local financial institution, that enabled you to visit certain resorts.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Thanks for putting it more succinctly than I did. But now they've taken that away, and I did not do it right away. I did not make that investment. So now they have a 30-month. You have to do a 30-month CD and put in $1,000 or more. But each 10 months, you can take out money without penalty. Is that a good deal?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I really believe that we're going to see some increasing interest rates. So I'm a little concerned about just tying your money up for 30 months. 12 months, 18 months, 9 months, that would be where I would have my money tied up. I'm not very excited about tying my money up.
13?
No, 9, 12, 18.
9, 12, 18.
I wouldn't really want to go out any further than 18 months in a certificate of deposit.
Okay. And could you give me a nicer word than I might use for what I feel the bank did when they, all of a sudden, you get midstream and they change the rules?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, in the car business sometimes it's called bait and switch, but I'm not willing to say that's what happened because I'm not really certain of what took place. But that's sort of the way you're describing it. But I guess I'd be a little unhappy too, but whatever. You should complain probably to them. I presume you did.
No, I haven't.
Oh, well.
I just found out about it.
Okay.
I was going to make the deposit now. So who do I speak to about something like that, the president or who else?
No, I think probably you could start with your personal banker or one of the people who offers the program. But I would be very nice about it and let them explain it to you.
That's why I'm asking you the nicer terminology.
Yeah. That's right. So you could ask them about it and feel that maybe you didn't either understand the whole program or alternatively that they sort of changed the rules in midstream. So give them an opportunity to re-explain it to you and suggest, well, tell me about your rates for 9 months, 12 months, and 18 months. Okay?
Okay. Thanks
All right.
so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much and good luck. We'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number 3. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering if you might you discuss the capital gains exemptions for single and married couples. And I was wondering, what administration was that? Was there a law that was passed recently?
What administration was that under? Well, it wasn't under Bush, so it was under Clinton, I believe.
I see.
That's when I think that took place. And if I'm wrong, maybe there's an accountant out there who can correct me. So I'm not sure whether it was at the beginning of the Bush administration or the Clinton administration.
Well, you know, just hearing that, as a homeowner, if I were going to sell my house, I personally wouldn't mind paying a moderate tax on my capital gains, you know,
okay,
to throw it into social benefits, you know, health, education, that kind of stuff. And I'm wondering, you know, what are your thoughts on that? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Well, I have no problem with paying capital gains tax on income property, But typically on a personal asset, I'd have to really think about it. I really haven't got an opinion off the top of my head on it. But I can tell you with income properties that even though we pay lower tax rates on dividends, for example, we actually pay higher capital gains rates on income property with respect to real estate. For example, if you go out and you buy a share of IBM stock for a dollar, and you later sell it for $101, you have a capital gain of $100. And under current federal tax law, you would pay a 15% capital gains tax. On the other hand, if you have an income property that you bought for a dollar and you sold it for $101 and had a $100 capital gain with respect to a real estate property, at bare bones, you would be paying a 20% capital gains tax on that real estate. And indeed, a portion of your real estate would even be taxed at a higher rate, which is the recaptured amount of depreciation, which is a little bit more complicated. So real estate doesn't enjoy, at the time that you sell, necessarily some of the gains and some of the benefits of the stock market, for example. Now, real estate does have other benefits. You can depreciate your real estate. You can rent your real estate, et cetera, and hopefully you have a cash flow from your real estate. So there are other benefits as well. But it's important to recognize that when you sell your real estate, if you don't exchange into another piece of real estate, you're actually paying a higher tax rate. And for purposes of the state of Illinois, when you sell your stock at a capital gain, you would pay 3% capital gains tax on that gain, and the same with your real estate. So those are the current rules as far as I understand them.
Did I get your question? Oh, I guess the caller is gone, so we'll move on. And let me just mention again, we're past our midpoint here with David Sinnoh, professor of finance at the University of Illinois, talking about personal finance, the real estate market, et cetera. Any questions you have are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And a Chicago listener is next on line number 4. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
I'm curious about this idea of putting your Social Security money into a private account. There's talk, all kinds of talk about that. What would that do to the stock market?
Well, there have been lots and lots of pundits and lots of commentary about it, and I think it's important to remember that it's a voluntary program. People forget about this. That no one under, as proposed or as the trial balloons have been pushed up thus far, that it is entirely voluntary with people whether or not they would even put money into private accounts. And I know that, Jack, I think you've had several programs about it, and so I don't really want to spend a tremendous amount of time talking about it. So the answer is I really don't know. Because I think it would be based upon the numbers of people and the amounts of money that would be going into such a program. But I can tell you that from my understanding of it, that people would have choices between fixed income, which is the bond market, and the stock market. And if you figured that 50% of the money went into the bond market and only 50% went into the stock market, and it's a voluntary program at a low percentage, I'm not so certain that it's going to have any major dramatic impact on increasing the market value of stocks. That's sort of an initial analysis.
Yeah, let's wait and see.
I guess so.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. And it is a topic that I'm sure we will be taking up on future shows as well as the debate over Social Security reform, revamping, whatever you want to call it, continues. Meanwhile, we have a couple callers waiting. We'll get next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Question about these mortgages and stuff like that.
Sure.
We bought our house about 3 years ago here in Champaign County, and we did one of those kind of a mixed loan where 80% was an actual mortgage, and then 10% was a home equity loan, and then we put down 10%. So we had basically two different loans, and about a year later we refinanced at about 5.25% for the full mortgage, but the home equity loan we didn't refinance. It's a standalone loan, but that's at a higher rate. That was like a fixed 7% loan. So now we're at the point where I think we only have a year left to pay off the home equity loan, which was at about $25,000, and we actually refinanced for a 15-year mortgage on the main mortgage. So now we're wondering, we'd like to buy a car. We haven't bought a new car in many years, and we're just wondering if it's a good idea to refinance everything, including the home equity loan, and maybe take some of that money and buy like a new used car. We don't like buying new cars totally. And then just trying to take advantage of the lower rates now, because we know they're going to go up anyway. What do you suggest?
Well, those are all good questions. Let me ask you a couple of preliminary questions. And that is, do you have enough equity in your house to refinance all of the outstanding indebtedness into one master mortgage?
Probably by the end of, maybe by the middle of the summer, we should. The way we figured it out so far is that we've probably paid off maybe about $20,000 off the main loan, and then we've probably paid off a good about $10,000. So I think that'll cover the $25,000 of that equity loan.
Okay. Well, your 5.25% rate, of course, is a very handsome rate. And I think you'd be moving up, if you refinance over that 15-year period, to about a 5.75% currently.
Okay.
All right? So you would be sacrificing a little bit of interest rate there. However, I really am not excited about your second, because, one, that's going to come due, and, two, if you have to renew that second, it's probably going to be at a significantly higher rate, especially if interest rates move up.
Well, that's the second mortgage. We've only got like a year left to pay that off.
Right. And basically, at the time that that mortgage is due and you sit down with the bank, they will be delighted, if you have substantial equity in your home, to renew that second or that second line of credit. The only problem is that, again, interest rates might be higher and you're paying a premium to have that second out there.
So our plan is we've been paying more.
Yes, I see that. But I would rather have you be paying more against your second, not your first.
No, we're not. The first one, we're not. We've worked it out. It's not a we'd be a little bit more, but not a lot more. It's the second one that we've doubled the payments.
Good. And what's the outstanding balance on the second?
Second is only like about, I think I calculated that we've only a little bit over, what did I say? We only have a year left, so that's probably about $10,000 maybe left on it.
All right, and your idea is to refinance all of it so that you could pay off the second and buy the car.
Right.
All right, and is the car an absolute necessity?
No. It's just that we had a baby about a year ago.
Congratulations.
Thanks, and it's a smaller car. So.
All right.
You know, it's,
I understand people need cars.
It's usable.
I won't give you my standard car lecture other than to say I like the idea of you buying a car that is not a new car.
Right.
Because typically that first year you can save yourself 40%. That's how much many of these cars depreciate.
Right.
And then the most important element when you buy the car is what you need, not what you want, and safety, especially with a child.
Right.
So I am really into side curtain airbags, for example, which
well,
of course costs
more. Right. We could maybe get a, they came out about a year ago, so we're thinking if we could find, you know, about a year old.
This
like
is good thinking. This is good thinking. This is good thinking.
It's got all the stuff that we would want.
Well, you don't need all the bells and whistles. You need the safety features.
Right. Well, that's
what you need.
Stuff,
that's what you need.
Yeah, we don't want the DVD in the car.
You don't need any of that. You don't need sunroofs. You don't need any of that stuff. So I applaud you for paying down this second. I'm very happy about that. I can understand your desire to refinance the whole thing. I just, as you know, I'm negative on debt. It's very important that you properly manage your debt.
Right.
And that is the most important element of getting ahead with kids, with family, is proper management of debt.
Well, that's why we figured instead of taking a loan out for the car, if we refinanced it, maybe it's, you know, hopefully, we have to look at the rates. We have to look at
absolutely.
That.
The answer is that if you take a personal loan out for the car, the interest is not tax deductible,
right,
if indeed you're itemizing. Are you itemizing?
Yes.
Okay. So in that sense, you probably don't want a personal car loan.
Right.
And so it may well be, if you are very prudent in your car purchase, you continue to pay down on these loans as much as possible and manage debt. I'll go along with you and give you my okay to refinance. But you shop that refinance. You shop it and get the lowest rate.
That was the second question I had, because we when we first moved here, even before we moved here, we actually went with just a local bank, just because we didn't. It was kind of our first purchase.
This is a competitive business.
So we
should
look elsewhere.
Bottom line is, where do you get the best deal?
Okay.
That's it. Compare apples and apples.
And do you have a good recommendation for a place to look for those rates?
I think there are any number of places in Champaign County. They are all very competitive. They are very ethical. And your job is just to get the best rate and compare rates.
Okay. So even using a local bank isn't a bad deal.
Local bank, or certainly don't discount the local mortgage companies as well. The local mortgage brokers. Make certain that you check not only the banks but the mortgage brokers and compare rates.
Now,
the local newspaper has rates that are quoted each weekend with phone numbers, so you could take a look at that. And I must say that I see we've got about three or four phone calls waiting.
Yeah.
So I think we better move on, but it's been a pleasure talking with you.
If you could just say a word or two about mortgage brokers as opposed to bankers, I'll hang up and I'll listen.
The only difference between mortgage brokers and mortgage bankers is typically mortgage bankers use their own money to close the loan, but then they immediately sell it into the secondary market. Mortgage brokers, on the other hand, have the money sent to them. It is not their money, and then that loan is sold into the secondary market. That's the only difference. It's invisible as far as you are concerned. You are interested in where you get the best rate, the best terms, and the lowest closing costs.
Okay. Couple callers waiting. We'll get next to a listener. I'm not sure where they are calling from on line number two. Good morning.
Hello. My question is about IRA withdrawals for older citizens. Recently, it's come upon me to straighten out some of my father's affairs. He's near to 90. And basically, he had apparently $80,000 in an IRA at his bank and some other figure at an IRA with an investment company. He rolled over the $80,000 from one IRA and had it entered into the other, and a net of approximately $5,000 ended up in my dad's possession, I guess, as his annual amount he has to withdraw to avoid some kind of penalty. My questions about this are, one, can you explain briefly the rules of that caused my dad to have to withdraw this money every year? And second, as regards that $5,000 that ended up being withdrawn, I've pretty well determined that the bank made a mistake filling out one of the forms, and I want to know what is the form number or paperwork that the bank should have issued to my dad regards that annual withdrawal money.
Okay, those are great questions. First of all, we have to know what kind of IRA this is. I presume this is a traditional IRA as opposed to a Roth IRA.
That's correct.
Okay, because with a Roth IRA, the truth of the matter is you never have to take the money. There are no minimum distribution rules. with respect to a Roth IRA. So you could be in your 80s or 90s and never take any money out. With a traditional IRA, generally you are required to take what's called a minimum distribution. That's what your father was required to take, a minimum distribution once you are 70 and a half. The actual rule says the April following the year in which you are 70 and a half, but that creates another complication. So most people take their first minimum distribution when they are 70 and a half or older during that calendar year. And there is an IRS chart based upon the age of the individual and the named beneficiary determining then what percentage of the previous year-end's balance has to be withdrawn. Now, when your dad rolled his $80,000 into another IRA because he was older than 70 and a half, then he was required at the time that he rolled that money to take a minimum distribution then before that money was rolled into that second IRA, and that's why your dad got the $5,000. That $5,000, number one, is subject to federal income tax. So you would have to pay federal income tax on it. And typically, the institution may have withheld 10% of that amount and sent it already to IRS. So you got to find out whether any money was sent by the IRA sponsor directly to IRS. Also, by the, what's the date? January 31st, the bank should have sent a 1099. And that 1099 would have shown that IRA distribution. The 1099 form would have been sent to your dad. A copy already would have been sent to the government. So they will then know that you have properly reported that on your 1040.
On the 1099,
yes,
the amount listed should have said the $5,000 number.
Unless there was a larger number, like $5,500, and $500 was sent to the government.
Okay. Now, I was correct about the mistake because they did. I got a copy of the 1099.
Yes.
And they filled in the first box, gross distribution, 80 grand. And then, and I'm positive this was their mistake, box number two says taxable amount. And they put 80 again. Which
okay,
wasn't no. Right.
Well, what happens is they don't know that you rolled that money over. All right?
I think they did because they made the check to the other institution,
well,
not my dad.
Well, that's right. They should have done what's called a trustee-to-trustee transfer, which it sounds like they did. So it probably is coded incorrectly. Had they written you the check, then it would have showed taxable $80,000. And then on the 1040, you would have shown that you rolled it over within 60 days, so there would be no taxes owing. So you probably should get a corrected 1099 from the bank because this was a trustee-to-trustee transfer, and hence, only the distribution would have been taxable.
Okay, and then as to the 75 that went to the other institution, I've contacted them, and they let me know that a form, and I think it was 5498,
yes,
would be issued in May that would reflect that.
Right, that they coded it as a trustee-to-trustee transfer.
And when I asked, because my dad's representative, who's not the sharpest, indicated that she needed this before tax time, the investment institution explained to me the reason they wait till May is because you're allowed to continue to make contributions all the way up to April 15th.
That's absolutely correct.
Okay.
All right.
So beyond
what you're going to do is on the 1040, when it gets filed, you're going to show on your 1040 that only $5,000 is subject to income tax. That will basically solve the problem.
Okay. And so therefore, it follows then that the other institution, which had the other IRA, should have issued a 1099 for whatever amount the tables told them my dad had to withdraw for that.
That's correct.
Last year.
That's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay, best of luck. We have one caller waiting and probably time for others if you'd like to join us in the remaining 8 minutes or so. David Sinnoh is our guest, taking your questions on personal finance. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. An Urbana listener on line number 3 is next. Good morning.
Yes, hello. My question is this. I have $3,500 in a money market fund. It was a gift from a great-grandmother to my girl, who is 8 years old.
Oh.
And we were thinking about getting a computer, but this was a while ago, and I just let it sit there for several years, and I really should have put it in some kind of a fund to save for college. And I was wondering, do you recommend 529s or College Illinois or maybe just a Vanguard index fund? Or
well, I think you've hit all three. I like saving for college, which means a 529 plan. I have talked about College Illinois in the past, which is the prepaid tuition program. And that's a great way to get started because tuition, as you and I know, is only going to go up. So that would be a wonderful use of the funds. With College Illinois, you can go to their website, www.collegeillinois.com. You can read all about it, and you can buy semesters of prepaid tuition. And you can buy it all at once. You can buy it over time. And with an 8-year-old, I believe you could even pay for it monthly. And you don't have to buy 8 semesters. You could buy 1 semester or 2 semesters. So I think that would be a wonderful thing to do with that money is prepaid tuition. Alternatively, you could go to the other traditional form of a 529 plan where you essentially invest the money in a program. The money grows tax-free so long as the money is utilized for any kind of college educational expenses. And that, of course, presumes that you're a good investor and have made good choices. And I happen to like the Vanguard program. Vanguard offers a number of excellent choices as far as a 529 program goes. So I think you're right on point. College Illinois makes sense. A 529 program through Vanguard makes sense just as well.
And do you know if either of them would inhibit them, like if they're following their ability to obtain scholarships or even financial aid? I mean, is that a consideration as well?
Well, it is, but I wouldn't count on it.
Okay.
And who knows what the rules are going to be with an 8-year-old 10 years from now.
Sure.
All right. So I think you want to presuppose that this responsibility and this burden is going to fall on you. And the more you can do to ameliorate that impact now makes good sense.
Okay. And last question, what about commodity fund indexes? What do you think of those?
I think that's for the birds.
Okay.
I think it's for people who are extraordinarily sophisticated, and I think it's a good way to lose your money.
Okay, great. Thanks for telling me.
Short and
sweet.
Tell
it straight like it is, and we appreciate that.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. A couple callers waiting. We'll try to get them both in. Line 1, listener in Urbana next. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. I was listening to the beginning of your show, and you were talking about real estate and how to kind of plan for or avoid this bubble that might be popping up in certain parts of the country. And you mentioned a relationship. If I recall correctly, you said that the best predictor of overvalued real estate was the long-term employment rates?
Actually, what I said is I was quoting from a Smart Money study that used a survey and a form of analysis which compared escalating prices to escalating incomes of individuals in the area. And where you had a tremendous increase in prices as compared to incomes in the area, that might indicate a market bubble.
Great.
And where you had income sort of in tandem with increases in prices, that's a fairly valued area. And where you had prices relatively stable or perhaps even decreasing, yet you had incomes of individuals moving up, that might be an undervalued area.
Okay, that is excellent. And I was looking on the Census Bureau website as you were doing this, which might explain why I was having trouble following what you're saying, and I was actually having a little bit of trouble finding some of this data. Can you recommend a portal?
You know, I'd have to look it up. I spent some time on the U.S. Census data, and I remember utilizing some key terms, and I guess you could call me off the air. Okay. You want to call me off the air, WIL has my phone number, and I'll take a look into it for you.
Great. I'd appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We will squeeze in one last caller, Urbana listener, line number two. Good morning.
Hi. I'm calling with regard to what you said, David, about 15% tax on capital gains for stocks vis-a-vis a larger capital gains tax on real estate?
That's correct, on income property.
Income property.
Not your home, but income property.
So what about family property that's undeveloped?
Well, family property that's undeveloped is income property. So if you sold that piece of real estate at a gain, typically you would pay, if it's vacant land, a 20% capital gains rate.
Hadn't heard that before.
Okay, that's the rule.
Okay, thank you.
All right, a pleasure hearing from you.
Good to hear from you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for the call. Well, we just have about a minute left, and I had one quick follow-up on the issue of the real estate bubble, quote-unquote, whether or not it exists in any particular location. And we talked about the fact that low interest rates have contributed to the rise in housing prices. We are entering a time when the federal deficits and various other deficits are sort of pushing the pressure on interest rates
pushing the envelope
to go up. And, you know, presumably that would mean that it would cost more for people to do these home buying transactions.
No question.
And would it therefore impact prices?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is certainly a factor that could exacerbate the situation. No question about it. But again, the overriding factor is job creation. If we're in an area where we believe that there is going to be substantial job creation over the next 5 to 10 years, that is the leading indicator of where prices are going in residential real estate.
Okay. We'll have to leave it there. Our guest has been David Sinnoh, professor of finance here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He joins us on the third Friday of every month to take your questions. And as always, a great pleasure to have you with us.
Jack, it's been lots of fun today. Just lots of great questions.
Thank you, David.